Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next. November is Native American Heritage Month, a time to honor the history, culture, and resilience of Indigenous people. On today's show, we reflect on the remarkable life and legacy of Eli S. Parker, a Tonawanda Seneca leader, engineer, and Civil War officer who helped draft the terms of surrender at Appomattox. In the 1840s, Parker was denied admission to the New York State Bar simply because he was Native American. Now, more than 175 years later, that injustice is finally being corrected. Amongst our guests today, we have Melissa Parker Leonard, educator and Parker's descendant, and Lee Redeye, attorney and member of Seneca Nation, reflecting on what this recognition means today. It's a story of history, resilience, and representation. Ahead on What's Next, but first, the news.
This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. One Buffalo area congressman plans to support a proposed agreement to end the federal government shutdown, while another says it's a bad deal and he will oppose it. Late Monday, the U.S. Senate passed a measure that would end the current shutdown. Republican Nick Langworthy, through social media, says the shutdown is, quote-unquote, a partisan unfair attack on the American people, and he intends to vote in favor of the agreement. Meanwhile, Democrat Tim Kennedy says the agreement continues an assault on affordable health care. He also calls out House Speaker Mike Johnson, suggesting the leader has lost credibility.
A shutdown of 41 days and another 11 days shut down because they canceled votes since September 19th and have gone on a taxpayer-funded vacation. Now he's going to call back the House to vote on a bad deal for the people of America that's going to rip away their health care. Shame on him and shame on anybody that goes along with this betrayal on the American people.
Democrats who remain opposed to the agreement says there must be an extension to affordable care tax credits that are set to expire at the end of the year. Two local elected officials are reaching across the aisle to introduce legislation designed to retain members of New York's National Guard. Under the bill drafted by State Senate Minority Leader Rob Ort and Amherst Town Supervisor-elect Sean Lavin, National Guard troops who are deployed for 60 days or more on state orders would receive extra credit in civil service examinations. Ort, who once served in the New York Army National Guard himself, says it's a material way of saying thank you to those deployed by the state for longer periods of time.
As you know, a lot of members of the Army National Guard, they go into other types of public service positions. They're taking civil service exams, and those 2.5 points might be the difference between them being hired to be a police officer or not being hired to be a police officer or a firefighter or what have you.
Lavin still serves as a major in the U.S. Air National Guard. He came up with the first draft of the legislation after National Guard troops were sent into state prisons during the corrections officers' walkout earlier this year.
The National Guard of New York State continues to answer the call. They're the first ones to wake up and say, I'm going to step up to the plate and I'm going to own this situation and I'm going to be here for as long as it takes. And the law needs to catch up to that sacrifice.
According to Ort, the bill still needs a sponsor in the state assembly. Evergreen Health is working to restock its two affiliated food pantries following a wave of crushing demand. Last week, with SNAP benefits suspended, the Evergreen Health Food Pantry on South Elmwood Avenue and the Community Access Services Food Pantry on Bailey Avenue served 250% more people than an average week. In October, Evergreen served 30% more people than the previous 18-month average. As the pantries restock, the agency is welcoming food donations from the community. There's more information at evergreenhs.org. This is BTPM NPR.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. I'm Jay Moran. We're live this morning, as a matter of fact, with What's Next. And I'm very pleased to have this conversation coming up for the next hour. It's going to revolve around Ely Parker. I think maybe a lot of people might know the name, might mispronounce his name like I did, Eli. But Ely Parker lived from 1828 to 1895, was a Tonawanda Seneca leader, engineer, Civil War officer, who was denied admission to the New York State Bar in the 1840s because, at that time, Native Americans not recognized as citizens. Well, on Friday, that is going to change when the New York State Supreme Court Appellate Division, 4th Department, posthumously admits Ely Parker to the bar. On Thursday night, the Buffalo History Museum will host a panel discussion, Ely Parker, From Exclusion to Admission. And with us, two members of that panel. One is Lee Redeye. Lee is the Deputy Counsel for the Seneca Nation of Indians. Thanks for joining us, Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And also Melissa Parker Leonard. Melissa is an educator, public historian, founder of Seventh Gen Cultural Resources, which provides research, education, and advocacy for partners and clients, and also a descendant of Ely Parker as well. Thanks for being with us, Melissa.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Should we go through the descendants of the Parkers and how it comes down to you from Ely?
Sure. So my father was a Parker and a Tonawanda Seneca, and I learned from him, you know, our connection to Ely and how our family descends from Ely. And my grandfather, Levi, was Ely's older brother.
Okay. Now, when we, in my description of Ely Parker, I mean, we're talking about somebody, I only touched on some of the highlights of his really amazing career, but I think about how we, you know, like my high school, boys' high school, they always told us to be Renaissance men, men who did all these different types of things. Well, here's an Ely Parker who not only, you know, was a scholar, he was a leader, you know, an engineer. He did all these different types of things. And I'm just wondering, as you look at Western New York history, how should he fit inside that when we talk about, we got statues over next to City Hall about some people who were, resided here in Western New York, were famous. Where do you think an individual who achieved what Ely Parker achieved, where he should kind of fit in all that? How should we look at it?
Well, I think he fits into the fabric of this region. And when we think of where we are today, physically, it was Buffalo Creek territory. And during Ely's lifetime, after the Erie Canal opened and when Ely was born, the Senecas had four territories at that time: Tonawanda, Buffalo Creek, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny. And when Ely was 10 years old, the Buffalo Creek Treaty of 1838 was signed. And in that treaty, we lost all territories. And then a few years later, Buffalo Creek Treaty was signed in 1842, and Buffalo Creek and Tonawanda were lost in that agreement, and Cattaraugus and Allegheny stayed. So Ely was born during a time where it was tumultuous, and that land struggle was happening. And so the Senecas were called on to, in survival mode, try to retain what land they could. So that's sort of the time period that Ely was born into.
And Lee, as an attorney, I would think there might be an interesting connection or thought about Ely Parker's life.
Yeah, I think the point you raised about Ely or about Renaissance men, I think Ely embodied that. He really was a Renaissance man, and I've actually referred to him as such in conversations with friends
and colleagues. Just to be clear, my high school teachers did not consider me a Renaissance man.
I think if you take any of his achievements, you know, being a leader for the Seneca people, I don't want to get too far ahead of the conversation, but, you know, his legal scholarship, his academic scholarship, engineering, any of those would have made for a remarkable life. And Ely, as one man, did all of them. And so I think he does deserve honor and recognition. And the bar admission ceremony on Friday will be the first step in that. And maybe there's more. Maybe there is, you know, a statue that gets built somewhere for him. I think I would like to see that, just recognizing, I think right down by the courthouse, we have a statue of a Seneca woman. And so I think, you know, it's just, respecting that the Senecas were the first people here, that this was our land from time immemorial and that we're still here. And so I think that's important to recognize and to sort of, commemorate moving forward.
And most certainly, you know, I think a discussion about, like you said, the we're still here is quite the story in itself. Tonawanda Senecas specifically being still here. I mean, when you read the story, against all odds in a lot of ways. I mean, for a long time, it looked for sure like the Tonawanda Senecas were either going to be moving to Cattaraugus, or Allegheny, or maybe even to Kansas was part of it. Ely Parker played a key role in making sure that didn't happen.
He did. He as a, you're speaking about high school,
right?
And that puts him into perspective. He was a teenager.
Wow.
And learned English, and he began as a translator for the Tonawandas. And he was called upon by leadership at the time to translate directly with the U.S. president. And I think that we were very diplomatic,
mm-hmm.
and you know, learned English and strategized for a long time in order to retain the territories that we did. And Tonawanda specifically strategized after the land was sold in order to prevent surveyors and assessors to come onto the territory. And that ultimately worked out in 1857 when they were allowed, given permission to stay on their own territory.
And to buy back their own land.
Yes.
Yes. It's really a great story. And any kind of enlightenment we can bring to it today would be I think worthwhile for sure, because
if I could,
please,
just, yeah,
please.
Just I just want to add on to that, because I think it is important to tell the story, as abbreviated as it may be in this program, but the story of the Seneca people's survival in their ancestral lands, which is Western New York. Ely was born about 50 years after the Sullivan campaign in 1779, which sought to eradicate the Haudenosaunee people from the central New York, Western New York area. And that sort of had a profound effect on relationships between the Haudenosaunee people, the nations, and also it drove a large body of the Haudenosaunee to Buffalo Creek. And I believe, you know, I could be wrong on this, and Melissa is the historian, so she could correct me, but I believe that even the Grand Council fire was located here at Buffalo Creek for a time, just showing how devastating that campaign was. And it was, certainly, you know, by all accounts, scorched earth campaign, something I think if it happened in modern times, it would be viewed as perhaps a war crime.
Genocide.
Genocide is kind of where I'm going. It's an indiscriminate killing of men, women, and children, burning of food stores, sort of salting the earth so that they couldn't return. And I think that was, you know, you can look at the letters that George Washington wrote to John Sullivan, and they direct him to do that. And so I think that is, you know, he was born 50 years after that. And I think the Haudenosaunee people were still reeling from those events. Then you have 1838, as Melissa talked about, 1842, we got two of our territories back, but we did lose Buffalo Creek and the Tonawanda territories. And then you have shortly thereafter, and within Ely's lifetime, you have the boarding schools. So the Thomas Indian School came about on the Cattaraugus territory, and their stated mission was to educate and civilize and Christianize the Indians so that they wouldn't want to return to the reservations or the territories, that they would go out into the world and forget that they were Seneca or Onondaga or Cayuga, Tuscarora, or whatever it may be, because all Haudenosaunee people had their children taken to that school. And that was run by the state of New York. And so the fact that we're still here, I think, is remarkable and a testament to the resiliency of the Seneca people, the Haudenosaunee people. And also, I think, you know, we had allies at that time and we can't forget them as well. Right. But I think it's important to know that kind of history, the context in which Ely lived, because I think Melissa hit it right on the head. He was born in a very tumultuous time, and he's seen, he witnessed a lot of things occur within his lifetime that I think would have, you know, possibly destroyed nations that maybe weren't as tough or resilient or fierce, as we say, as the Seneca people.
And just to add a little editorial to the Thomas Boarding School, we've done a couple of programs on that here, and you could say, you know, the mission was to civilize and eradicate the history, but I mean, you could also say that it was a place where torture took place. There's I don't think there's any doubt about that.
It's certainly cultural genocide, attempted cultural genocide, right. And it even, the effects of the Thomas Indian School continue to echo even today, I think. You know, we don't have as many Seneca language speakers because a lot of the people who went there, who were sort of residents at the Thomas Indian School, prisoners at the Thomas Indian School, they had that sort of beaten out of them not to speak the language. And not just Seneca. I think it goes for all Haudenosaunee people. Sure. Any nation who had their children sent there is profoundly impacted by it. But since we're talking about Senecas today.
That's all. That's fine. That's what we have an hour to discuss. And so Ely learns the language, becomes an interpreter or translator. And something just kind of one of these things that, as you, I'm sure you've lived through this and uncovered your own history about this, but you know, a lot of these negotiations that were going on with these treaties, you know, were done in a language that a lot of the people at the table, people who represented Senecas or any other native people, didn't really necessarily know what was being translated, right? I mean, that's a big part of how some of these treaties really came to pass.
It's true. And I think one, to put it into perspective, Haudenosaunee governance predates that of the United States. And when, you know, we're coming up to America 250, that's a really important perspective. You know, we are talking about hundreds and hundreds of years of governance by consensus and balance between men and women. So when treaties were negotiated, you know, rarely was it translated. I've rarely seen treaties translated to native languages. But I also think that as time went on, treaties were negotiated between sovereign nation to sovereign nation, the federal government and the Haudenosaunee people as a sovereign entity. And as time went on, the land companies came into the picture. And so there were multiple individuals involved in those negotiations representing the federal government, representing New York State, representing the land company, and it got confusing. And so, you know, you throw into that real estate legal terms of, you know, land being transferred permanently. There was a lot of confusion about that concept from the indigenous perspective. There was no deed for these territories. There wasn't a physical deed to transfer Buffalo Creek over to the Ogden Land Company. So it was very nuanced in regards to discussions between indigenous leaders and then ultimately the land company is who the agreement of the Buffalo Creek Treaty was made between. So I think there were misunderstandings. And then to relate to what, you know, Ely's role, the Seneca people had to rely on non-native lawyers and trust in paying them that they would represent their interest. And that was really problematic. And there was a lawyer named Charles Gold who took the money, got on a train and left and never came back. Hmm. And so, you know, those instances really create a mistrust. And I think Ely's, and not just Ely, any native person from taking the bar exam from that time period, it was part of a larger strategy to get the land. And I think that it was part of the Ogden Land Company really getting involved in wanting Buffalo in particular.
Well, you're the educator here, so you can tell me if I'm wrong to bridge this part of the conversation. But you brought it up about consensus. This could bring us a little bit of a conversation about the difference in governing that takes place at Tonawanda Seneca and also at the Seneca Nation of Indians as well. Seneca Nation Indians, again, I'll allow you to correct my poor framing of this, basically became a democracy with elected president and elected leaders. But the Tonawanda Seneca remained with the Council of Chiefs and relied on consensus, correct, in whatever decision that they were going to make, correct?
Correct.
How about that? But that still exists today, right?
It does. It does.
That's right. And we just don't know. You are a descendant of the Tonawanda Seneca Nation, but you don't speak for them.
Right. And that's where I like to make the point. You know, I don't speak for.
But I think it's a worthwhile understanding. I mean, I think people see, I don't live too far from Tonawanda Seneca, so I've seen the signs for years. And only till maybe the last couple of years did I really understand, though both are Senecas, there is a distinction to be made here, right?
And I think it lends itself to, we are very community-based. And we, living in longhouses was communal. We lived with families according to our clan. And Ely's time period shifted that from, we entered into a log cabin era where individual families lived with their individual families. And it's important to understand that shift because the land companies understood it. And when they were negotiating treaties, the land companies started to separate the chiefs into mansions on Delaware Avenue to have private conversations. And it really, they understood that system and they created tension amongst the leadership. But I will say historically for the Tonawanda Seneca chiefs, not one of them signed the Buffalo Creek Treaty. So they were, in rhythm with the terms of that treaty. They understood and they did not sign the Buffalo Creek Treaty.
And I'd just like to back up, because I think that the Haudenosaunee would certainly, and I agree, but I think they would certainly advocate that they are a democracy, that perhaps the oldest, still democracy still in existence today. They have a representative form of democracy. And, I don't feel it's my place to kind of opine about their government system and how it works, because, it's outsider looking in sort of situation. But the Seneca Nation, at least, has transitioned to a constitutional democracy. We have an elected form of government. Actually, the events of 1838 and 1842 are largely attributed to the Seneca Revolution of 1848, which was when the Seneca Nation of Indians was born, I guess you could say. And in their list of grievances, they had a declaration of independence of their own. And in that, they talk about the traditional system and why they were moving away from it. And so you're correct. We have a elected president, J. Conrad Seneca, was elected last November. We have 16 counselors. We just had our judicial election. So our judges were elected for our court system. We have two trial level courts, the Peacemakers Court and the Surrogates Court. We have one court of appeals. And then the council sits as the Supreme Court to decide matters if a writ of permission is granted. So we have a system that I think in some ways resembles, the American system of government, but I think in other ways it does still harken back to the traditional form of government. And so it's a blend, right? And it's always evolving. There's constitutional amendments occurring all the time. And over the long arc of history, I think, the Seneca Nation's form of government has served it well. But I just wanted to give a little context to the two nations. And I think that the revolution in 1848 is really what split the two nations and put them on paths where you know, maybe someday in the future, they may come together again. But for now, we're two independently recognized nations, federally recognized nations. So we stand distinct, but our history is a shared history. And Ely, when he was born, we were actually still one nation.
Right.
So he also saw that, right? That speaking of all the sort of the tumultuous time in which he was born, Ely was born with one Seneca Nation, and he saw the split happen. And so that's just another thing that, you know, he lived in a remarkable time.
And a remarkable individual for that as well. We are talking about Ely Parker this morning on What's Next. With us today, we have Melissa Parker Leonard and also Lee Redeye, the Deputy Counsel for the Seneca Nation of Indians, with us here. Let's talk about now. All right, so Ely was not allowed to practice law. He wasn't allowed into the bar in the 1840s in New York State. That is going to be corrected, unfortunately, long after his death here on Friday. Let's talk about the process of trying or making this a reality. What can you tell us about how this progressed?
You know, so I was brought into the effort back in, I think it was maybe 2021 or late 2020, by John G. Browning. He's a retired judge from Texas and currently a professor, I believe, at Faulkner University, and Al Parker, Melissa's father. So they were working together at the time to get Ely posthumously admitted. John and Al had worked together to solicit letters of support from various organizations, the Native American Bar Association, the Native American Rights Fund, Western New York Minority Bar Association, author Lawrence Hopman, a ton. And I'm sorry if I'm forgetting some. I know I am. No disrespect, but there's so many of them.
Sure.
They're all included in our petition, all those letters of support. And as I said earlier, I think, you know, John and Al needed a horse to ride, and somehow my name came up, and John reached out of the blue one day when I was sitting at my office, and he asked me, do you want to help us? I'm working with Al from Tonawanda. Do you want to help us get Ely posthumously admitted? And immediately I was like, yes. You know, what do you need from me? What do we got to do? And so John and Jennifer Widger had actually been helping them. She actually went and searched the court records of Cattaraugus County Supreme Court. She's a court clerk over there, and she wasn't able to find anything, but she prepared an affidavit for us, and everything was kind of ready to go. We had some edits and revisions that we were working through on the petition to the Court of Appeals to waive the strict compliance with the requirements for admission to the bar. And it all kind of got paused for a little bit. We were looking for some further support, and we felt it was important enough that we get some sort of answer to kind of guide our direction to move forward. And, you know, we waited. And during this time, Judge Montour, who's been, you know, extremely helpful. And I think between the three of them, Al, John, and Mark Montour, they were really just kind of waiting in the wings to, you know, go through with this process. And unfortunately, we didn't get the support that we were kind of hoping for, but we also didn't get opposition. So earlier this year, and Melissa can kind of pick this up because I was kind of out of the loop. Like I said, John and Mark and Al were kind of moving this forward. But just earlier this year, I got brought back in. I got a call from Judge Montour. He said, Lee, I think it's time. Let's move forward. And that's kind of when I was introduced to Melissa being a part of the team. I had known Melissa just kind of professionally before on her Indian Park work. But had never met her. I think I spoke to her on the phone maybe once before that for 10 minutes. And so that's kind of how we got to the place we're at today. I'll let Melissa pick up and she can talk about how she got introduced, but then we can talk about the actual mechanics of how this works.
Sure, please, Melissa.
So what happened in 2022 is my father passed away and he would get phone calls and my parents still have an answering machine. So they would have messages on the answering machine that my mother asked me to start returning. She wanted me to explain to people, you know, what had happened. And it turned into an unexpected pathway for me. And I ended up taking up his work by returning those phone calls. And I spoke to Judge Browning briefly, and he really wanted me to write a letter of support. And I wanted to as well, but I quickly realized I need to know what I'm talking about. And it's big shoes to fill. And really, that was my dad's space, the history and the involvement in stewarding Ely's story. And so that's when I started to research. And I read Arthur Parker's book about Ely Parker. And in that book, he said, I left all of the materials I used to write this book in the History Museum's library. And so that was my starting point. I went through Arthur Parker's book of Parker family letters, and they're from the 1840s, and they're writing back and forth to each other. Ely's in Washington and the siblings are at Tonawanda, and they're writing about the anxiety of the fact that they didn't know what was going to happen to them. What's, you know, what will become of us? There's one line in particular that sticks out in my mind. They said, to lose the land is to cease to exist. And they really were talking about, we may not exist anymore. And that really struck me. And I realized I didn't know that story. I didn't know what happened at Buffalo Creek. How did we lose Buffalo Creek? And I just had more questions than answers. And that's really what history is. It's questioning. And so then I just started learning that history and talking about it with people. And then I realized I wasn't just taking up my father's work. I was connecting with other people that knew my father. And so in that way, I maintain a connection to him. So, you know, 3 years later, I felt comfortable enough in learning that history to now be able to write a letter in support of having Ely's admission to the bar, because I feel it was, you know, it's not just about Ely. It's about recognizing that strategy that removed us from the land.
There's a lot here, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation. With us this morning, Melissa Parker Leonard and also Lee Redeye. We're talking about Ely Parker tomorrow night, as a matter of fact, at the Buffalo History Museum, a panel discussion about Ely Parker and how on Friday he is going to be installed into the New York State Bar Association posthumously. We're going to take a break on What's Next. Come back with more. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Whether you're here for the headlines, the harmonies, or the next great song, you're in the right place. We've brought all our stations together under one name, Buffalo Toronto Public Media, BTPM NPR, BTPM Classical, BTPM The Bridge, BTPM PBS. Unique voices, one connected home for public media. New name, same great content. Discover more at btpm.org.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places, it can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. Today we are talking with Melissa Parker Leonard and Lee Redeye, and we're talking about Ely Parker from the Tonawanda Seneca Nation. Quite a story here. We've kind of got into the weeds here a little bit about how it's come to pass and all the effort that has gone into getting Ely Parker what he deserved, and that's being a part of the New York State Bar Association, something that's going to happen on Friday. But let's maybe get back to his story just for a little bit, just to kind of, as you said, Lee, you've thought of Ely as a Renaissance man, and you think about it. I mean, we don't want to, and I think we don't want to lose his vital part and vital role in making sure that, the nations remained it where in their ancestral lands here in Western New York, for sure. But also the other things that he was part of. I mean, he helped design the Genesee Valley Canal, which is another one of those kind of lost pieces of history here in Western New York, but quite the feat there as well. But also part of General Grant's, he worked with General Grant during the Civil War. I mean, let's just maybe get into a little bit more about Ely and the different types of things that he was part of during his life.
I think it's an interesting part of his story that when he couldn't practice law, he pivoted. Mm-hmm. And so he went into engineering, and that's where he met Grant. He was on a project in Illinois, and Grant came into, Grant worked at a store that Ely went into, and they struck up a conversation and then became friends. And I think when the Civil War broke out, Ely tried to enlist in the Civil War, and he was again told that similar message that you're Indian and we don't need your help. And so when Grant moved up in the ranks, he had special permission granted to Ely to join his staff. And so Ely entered the war effort as part of Grant's personal staff, and he traversed the war with Grant. And then I think he's most known for that culminating moment at the end of the Civil War, where the terms of surrender were signed at Appomattox, and Grant's secretary, who would have written out the terms, his hand was shaking because he was nervous. Mm. So Grant asked Ely, who had very nice handwriting, to write out the terms of surrender. And I think that's what he's most known for. But I think that part of the story where he was meeting with the president as a teenager, speaking a second language, I think that is an incredibly impressive part of his story, where, copying the terms of surrender is a little more passive. Right. But I think it is incredible where he ended up at the end of the war.
And then back to that key role that he played when it came to, in essence, saving. I mean, I don't think I'm overstating one to say that, there was an effort that 1840 to 1860 era where the future of the Senecas in Western New York was very much in doubt. And quite frankly, if I understand the history of this correctly, it was basically determined Senecas were going to be sent on their way somewhere else, right? Maybe just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think even though, the 1838 treaty where the Senecas were to give up all of their lands in Western New York and remove to west of Missouri, which is now modern day Kansas, and have lands there, the resistance that the Seneca people had to that notion of removing, some people did go down there, and I think there's actually a nation, Seneca Cayuga, I want to say, might be down there. Again, I'm hoping that Melissa will correct any of my errors, but so some people did, but the large body of Senecas remained here and refused to leave. And that actually kind of intertwines back with Ely's life much further down the road. But then you have 1842, the Senecas are granted their territory back, less Buffalo Creek and Tonawanda. And this all happened in Ely's early life. He goes on to study, read the law as it was in the day, with Angel and Rice at a law firm in Ellicottville. And just kind of interesting tidbit here, but on Friday, one of the people in the audience actually will have worked at the law firm that took over for Angel and Rice. So this like continuation of Ely's story or the sort of all these pieces kind of coming together. But back to the treaties and Ely's role in those. That would have happened by the time Ely was 14, I would say, when the territories were returned. Ely goes at 18 to read the law with Angel and Rice. And in 1846, a case had started. I believe it was Fellows v. Blacksmith. And that is about Joseph Fellows, who was part of the I guess a proprietor of the Ogden Land Company, but sort of one of the beneficiaries of the loss of the Seneca lands. And he goes and he forcibly removes a individual blacksmith, John Blacksmith, I believe his name was. And John Blacksmith was operating a sawmill on the Tonawanda Reservation, and Joseph Fellows goes there and forcibly removes him, saying, "I've got a deed, this is my land now." And Ely actually wound up working on that case with an attorney, John H. Martindale, mm-hmm. Who argued consecutive, well, in 56 and 58, argued two cases on behalf of the Tonawanda. And he was supported by Ely during those cases. Some historians or some books that I've read say that Ely kind of acted as a second chair, even though he wasn't admitted. He had all of that legal training from working with Angel and Rice, and he helped support. And shockingly enough, Fellows v. Blacksmith held that Fellows did not have the right to go remove people from that land, regardless if he had a deed or not, because only the United States possessed the authority to remove the Indians from Indian country, basically. Then you have another story, and this one kind of is a little more personal, in my life at least, but, Ely helped work on a case of three non-Indians had, moved on to the Tonawanda territory again under this, purported deed or right to the land, granted in the 1838 and 1842 treaties. And, They had invoked John Martindale, and Ely had utilized a state law to eject these people, to remove them from the territory. There was a state law dealing with intruders to the reservation in 1821. It was passed by the New York State Legislature, and Ely had used that. Ely and John Martindale had used that to remove these three non-Indians who had taken up residence on the Tonawanda territory. And that one, I think, was called X. Rel. Cutler v. Dibble. That one, again, worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, they challenged the constitutionality of that statute. So not as direct as sort of a defense of the land, but the impetus for the case was a defense of the land. And the U.S. Supreme Court found that statute to be a proper exercise of the state's police power. So Ely, you know, worked on two cases that went up to the Supreme Court. They both won. They both validated tribal rights or tribal occupancy. And so I think that kind of goes to his story as a Renaissance man, because, you know, as an attorney myself, if I had one case that went to the Supreme Court and won, I would call it a good career.
Move on.
Yeah. Then I might do something else. I might get into farming or something. I don't know. But he was such a remarkable individual. He had such a profound impact on our history. And I do want to bring it into kind of the modern day, because like I said, this second case that he worked on is something that's professionally and personally relevant to me today. That statute that Ely, the 1821 statute that Ely utilized, it's now Section 8 of the New York State Indian Law, and it relates to intruders to the reservation. And the Seneca Nation, over the past few years, has been experiencing an influx of what we're calling intruders to the territories. And it's non-Indians coming to the territory to, you know, engage in criminal activities. And the Seneca Nation has been forced to invoke Section 8 on at least two occasions in recent memory. And so and I help work on those under the direction of the president of the nation and, you know, the general counsel. We've been successful in getting those people removed. So the statute that Ely helped sort of validate, we're still using today. And it's unfortunate that we're still having to use this, but it is a useful thing to have, especially with the jurisdiction over non-Indians being sort of this, you know, quasi gray area kind of thing. But one other thing is that right now the Seneca Nation is actually advancing amendments to make that law better, the Section 8, to make it more useful, more relevant to the time. And that law was actually passed, that those amendments were actually passed by the Senate and the Assembly earlier this year, in June, I believe, of this year. And now it's just sitting on the governor's desk waiting for a signature, and we're hopeful that
the governor is not giving the Seneca issue her immediate attention.
Well, I would just like to say I think we would all encourage her to sign it, because it's going to help us, and sure, it'll help keep our territory safe. And I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be signed.
As you were talking about that, and it brought to mind another part of this story, that it's Ely Parker, but also the story of the Senecas remaining. And that is a very deft understanding of a lot of different elements of, you know, state law, federal law, but also even a changing political landscape in the United States as well. I mean, you know, there's the Andrew Jackson, Indian Removal Act, right? I mean, you know, there's that, but times changed as it went over. And I guess the question I'm wondering about here is, you know, when we relate to that understanding, what does that mean for individuals today who have a connection to the Seneca Nation? What do you think about that? I mean, because I think it's kind of a lost part of this whole story.
I think that it lends itself to this discussion we're having. And my experience in researching is that the history of the land has typically been written from a non-Native perspective. And so any story we can bring forward of, you know, any Seneca or Seneca history in general is incredibly important, particularly to the landscape that you're referring to right now. And I think that trying to quell the voices, silence the voices, it's not working, because it's making it even more important. I think Friday is so incredibly important in that landscape where those voices are, there's an effort to silence those voices. So I think to answer your question, it makes me want to, when someone tells me not to read something, it makes me want to read it even more.
Right. Anything to add to that, Lee?
I think, you know, practicing in federal Indian law, we're always trying to vindicate the rights of Native nations and Native people, the right to sovereignty, the right to determine your own future, to exist in whatever way your nation deems best. And, you know, we have a lot of, I guess, state and federal governments seem to be very adverse to that notion that we should have the right to determine our own destiny. But that's what is kind of, you know, in my eyes, kind of great about the U.S. legal system, is that we have the ability to fight for those rights. And so I think, you know, Ely Parker not being able to be a member of the bar kind of limited his ability to go to court and advocate. They found a willing, you know, a horse to ride again,
right.
John Martindale. But I think, you know, how much more profound it would have been if Ely himself would have been at the table and making those arguments. And so my perspective is that the event on Friday I hope that it will be inspirational to aspiring attorneys, Native American attorneys, Indian attorneys, because we don't have enough. I think in the last statistics I saw, which were from 2022, so it could be a little outdated, but in the entire United States, there's about 1.2 million attorneys. And of that, only 0.5% are Native American. So we're really underrepresented in the legal profession. I think Native Americans account for about 2% of the U.S. population, but we only account for a half a percentile of, or half a percentage of practicing attorneys. And so, you know, getting more Native Americans into the law, having that unique perspective that they can bring to fighting for justice, to fighting for sovereignty, for fighting for the right to exist, I think, will only create better circumstances for our future generations. And so I'm just, you know, I see Friday as hopefully a turning point for a lot of people, that they will recognize that, you know, some justice can be had in the U.S. legal system.
I'm curious. I don't think, after listening to you, Lee, or Melissa throughout this hour, that there's any doubt about your personal commitments to the issues of the nation. Do you find that there are other people picking this up, though, that sense, like you said, that sense of justice, that there are others, that this idea, this message, this spirit is spreading to where, you know, it's, you know, whether it's, like you said, more natives becoming attorneys or more people just getting involved, whether they're, you know, in nation residents or not. What about that? I mean, do you have a sense of where that's at?
So I think, to speak personally to that, one of my goals is to increase visibility in the city of Buffalo in regards to this history. And it is happening, because right now the Haudenosaunee flag is flying in front of City Hall. So those changes are happening, and there are, you know, there's people who want to see more of that. But I think for me personally, from, you know, my own family perspective, my goal is also healing, because this history hasn't been recognized, and it was generational. From the Sullivan-Clinton campaign, through the land loss, through the boarding school era. And so I think anyone who's willing to listen and help tell that story and give credence to that perspective is really important, because we have to acknowledge that this happened, and this happened to our families. And by doing so, you know, each generation can have that little bit of healing, so that it's better for all of us.
Any thoughts on that, Dan?
Yeah, I think, you know, in my personal experience, I have seen a concerted effort to try to raise awareness of Native issues and Seneca Nation issues in particular. I think, you know, our president, Seneca Nation president, J.C. Seneca, J. Conrad Seneca, has done an amazing job trying to educate lawmakers, educate local officials on the existence of the Seneca Nation. Even that, I mean, the lack of information that a lot of people have about us is sometimes shocking. I mean, it's one thing, I've lived it my entire life. Right. I've been a Seneca my whole life. So the knowledge, right, is inherent, but
I want to speak to that a little bit. 'Cause I mean, there's people ask, do you pay taxes? Do they still have teepees on the reservations? And it's, that is within the, you know, my lifetime.
Yeah. Right. Yep. No, and I think that's all correct. We do get a lot of questions, and I don't, you know, some people find them offensive. I think it's always good when somebody's asking questions and trying to get some more information. But, you know, we're constantly trying to educate people about who we are, that we're still here, and that we're not going anywhere. And I think that the current administration of the Seneca Nation has done an incredible job of highlighting or elevating our profile in the region, really letting people know that we're here. And so I think efforts are ongoing. It'll never be enough. No matter what we do, I just think, you know, hundreds of years of history is really hard to overcome, but we're doing the best we can. And, I think it's making a difference. And so I do think that, or I'm hopeful that, things will start to change. We'll see a change from that education and those efforts that are ongoing right now.
And we're down to our last few minutes here, but maybe this does bring up, I thought, a subset of our conversation is just that what, from your perspective, whether it's you as someone who grew up on the Seneca Nation and is now an attorney, or from your position as counsel, you, Melissa, with your connection with your family to Tonawanda Seneca, what do you want people to know? What do you want them to understand? What do you think could be help to spark, like you said, that better understanding of what the original residents of Western New York are all about? I mean, I know that there's a lot there, and you only have a couple of minutes. But I mean, is there something like we said earlier? What's next? That's the name of the show. So, what do you think? What strikes you?
I think one message that I've really honed in on is to stop talking about us in the past tense, and really, be very aware of saying we are here, we are part of this area, and this idea that we're still here, but that we are present. And I think it's speaks to the lack of visibility. In my lifetime, the visibility has been sports mascots and cartoons. Mm. And that is so problematic because of the stereotypes within that. But I've also seen the change where New York State gave the directive that schools have to eliminate mascots. So the changes are happening. And I just look forward to seeing more of that.
How about for you, Lee? Would you like someone to know? I think you've got a lot to offer on that.
Yeah, I think I've probably said it too many times here, but I keep saying it and I keep repeating it because I think it's important that the Seneca Nation has always been here. The Seneca people have always been here, and we'll be here forever. We're not going anywhere. We are. Powerful friends, or I guess I should say we're generous friends, powerful allies, and if necessary, we can be formidable opponents. But we choose to try to get along with everybody and have some level of mutual respect. And I think that's what we're working towards. And we are a force in the Western New York economy. And we just want to be respected for, as human beings and not sort of looked at, as Melissa said, as relics of the past, that we're still here, we're still present.
Any suggestions then from either of you about where someone can go to find out more? I mean, I've got my own sources, but I think you guys probably have something better than I do, I would imagine.
So, any thoughts? For the Seneca Nation, we have the Cultural Center in Salamanca, New York. It's our Allegheny territory, but Salamanca is where people can find it. That's the Seneca Nation Cultural Center. We also have Ganondagan in near Canandaigua, New York. I don't know exactly which township it's in,
right?
But they have like a replica longhouse. They have a lot of information there. You have the Seneca Nation of Indians website that they can go to. And I think, just Googling Seneca Nation and looking around, you're going to find a lot of information.
Sure.
You can type in Iroquois Confederacy, Six Nations, Haudenosaunee, whatever you want to call us. And tons of results are going to pop up. So just, be curious and, look into it a little bit and a trove of information will, be available.
Melissa, any thoughts?
I agree. I will be at the Cultural Center next Thursday, November 20th at 6 p.m. to talk about this history.
Okay.
And then I also sit on the board at the Buffalo History Museum. So, you know, I invite everyone to attend the panel discussion tomorrow evening at 6 p.m.
That is, of course, Thursday night, 6 p.m. at the Buffalo History Museum as we hear more about Ely Parker, who brought us to this discussion. The Thursday night discussion at the Buffalo History Museum, Ely Parker from Exclusion to Admission. Our guests this morning have been Lee Redeye, the Deputy Counsel for the Seneca Nation of Indians, and also Melissa Parker Leonard, educator, public historian, founder of 7th Gen Cultural Resources, and a relation of Ely Parker as well. Thank you both for being with us. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.